Greetings. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. This is Father Michael. As we continue our Christmas season, the 12 days of Christmas, today we reach into the mailbag and we put out a question for folks. What do you want to know about the Christmas season or the celebration of Christmas? Because today and these days is not the days after Christmas. These are 12 days of Christmas, the celebration of the Christmas season. And so in honor of the 12 days of Christmas, we have 12 questions that come from faithful podcast listeners on the 12 days of Christmas and all things Christmas. So 12 days, 12 questions. Our mailbag show last month was very successful and had lots of comments. And so we thought we'd dip back into the mailbag and to answer some questions about the history of Christmas, about how we might celebrate Christmas, and how the birth of Christ might be fruitful in our lives. And so whether you're on the go or taking it slow, Merry, Merry Christmas as you enjoy today's show.
Greetings and welcome back to St. Dominic's Weekly. This is Father Isaiah. That's Father Michael.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, Father Pastor.
Yeah, so we've got the... Now, as we're releasing this, we're in the midst of Christmas festivities and celebrations. I always have a little bit of a sinking feeling the day after Christmas, celebrating sometimes the early Mass, and then taking a walk around the block as I am wont.
Yes.
And on the...
I think I know where you're going.
Yeah,
here.
You know where I'm going with this. Everyone's throwing out their Christmas trees. It's kind of like it's garbage day the next day.
And they're brown and kind of gross, and they still have the string lights on it.
Exactly. So for us, as Catholics, I wanted to talk about today the 12 days of Christmas, because Christmas is not the end of something, but it's the beginning of something, right?
Yeah.
So we usually as kind of the inverted cultural celebration, it's from, well, gosh, now before even Halloween.
I know, right. Yeah.
Thanksgiving was late this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, six less shopping days we had this year, which wreaked havoc on different companies delivering packages and things like that. But what we had was a kind of celebration. And even here at the parish, we had our parish a party and things like that. So Advent becomes almost like Christmas light, if you will, all the way up to the big kind of bang of Christmas. And then the next day is kind of like, okay, back to the ordinary life, back to ordinary. But it's not ordinary time. Now we have 12 days, not just of Christmas, but in terms of days after Christmas, but it's the get used to the psalms we pray, get used to the liturgy we have, because it's exactly the same. We celebrate Christmas Mass over and over and over again, because the celebration of Christmas is so impactful that it can't be contained by one day.
Yeah. I mean, the great mystery of the incarnation of Christmas Day, I mean, that's why we call it an octave. So for 8 days, we celebrate this liturgy over and over again so that we can contemplate even more deeply of the great gift of the incarnation of the Son of God.
Yeah. So the idea with, I think last year we did, or in a previous year, we looked at the 12 Days of Christmas, that wonderful Christmas kind of carol.
Right.
And discovered how it was catechetical in nature, how it communicated the faith under the guise of a children's song. Do you remember what episode that was?
That was episode 16. Yeah.
Wow. Very good. Can you remember that? That was season one.
Season one. So we went through all those 12 gifts and the theology of the 12 gifts and spirituality, what they can teach us about the deeper mysteries of Christmas Day.
Nice. So if you're interested in that episode, what again?
16.
16. You can go back and you can listen to that. It might be a nice refresher for you. This year, I thought we'd take that same sort of theme, the 12 days of Christmas. And since our podcast last month that had kind of like for Advent, the Advent calendar theme of 24 questions for the 24 days of Advent, we thought we'd do 12 questions, mailbag questions for the 12 days of Christmas. So that was our longest podcast ever. Do you think we're going to be extending into
so we're on epic pace times? Of having this episode be what, like 45 minutes if the last one was an hour and 30?
That's right, if you do the math. But 12 questions for 12 days of Christmas. And thank you to all those who responded via social media to ask these questions. And let's just jump right in the Christmas spirit. So what do we have? Give me question. What's question number one that we had?
Question one, was Jesus really born on December 25th? And there's a parenthetical about Sol Invictus, so that Roman
holiday. So In terms of when Jesus was born, the short answer is we don't know historically necessarily that the 25th of December is the birthday of Jesus. There's
the precise date.
The precise date, as a precise date. So the question is, why did Christians, when and why, and how did that date become fixed now in our cultural experience? And it's not just here in the United States, but worldwide, and goes all the way back. Now, have to understand a couple of things. First, there's where there's not definite historicity, you're going to have different theories, if you will. So let me mention three. I'll give three different theories.
Okay.
And I'll give you the
three
father
theories for question one.
Three theories for question one. And I'll give you my likelihood. I'll put them on a likelihood meter for you.
Okay. All right.
On how
okay.
likely. So we'll go three stars of likelihood. How in terms of this is a personal opinion here. This is not the teachings of the church per se, but just what kind of makes sense given. The first is, as you mentioned, and as the person who wrote in mentioned, and if you go to, like, I don't know, History Channel or, you know, just Google, you know, Google Wikipedia or something, this is what you're going to find is that there's the claim that Christmas was celebrated as a kind of repurposing of an older Roman tradition of the celebration of the sun god in Latin, Sol Invictus, so the guy, the son of the victory. So the
triumphant sun.
Exactly, the conquering sun. Little problem with that, though. Okay, you can see where I'm going to fall on this theory. First of all, to say, even if this is true, I've never quite understood the critique, because here's how the argument goes. Well, Christmas is based on this pagan holiday, and therefore, Christmas is just kind of a rewarming. It's kind of leftovers. It's kind of
like
rewarming.
Like a remnant of the Roman Empire.
And it's like, therefore, the conclusion, I guess, is that somehow it's not real. Jesus wasn't really born. He's just one of many kind of myths. Jesus is real as Apollo. But the problem with that is you don't have to be a believer to know that Jesus historically existed.
Right.
I mean, that's just a fact. That's a F-A-C-T. Right?
Yeah.
No credible historian will deny the person of Jesus of Nazareth.
Right.
That's just a, so if the, if the point is that Jesus is a myth, that's just
a bad argument.
Yeah, that's just wrong. That's just false. That's just bad. That you've got some kind of agenda coming into it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, would this Christianity borrow from cultural kind of expression? Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, you think of the different places of worship.
Yeah.
If you do the archaeology, sometimes you get down and Soap Minerva, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
look at the name, you know, Soap Minerva.
Above, so there's a Santa Maria Soap Minerva, a beautiful in Rome church is basically dedicated to Our Lady, and it's built Sopra above the goddess Minerva of the temple Minerva. And so it's like, well, is that pagan worship? Because you've taken a place of pagan ritual but have transformed it towards its ultimate, you know, conclusion of Christ, who in beautiful different traditions of the church that see that Christianity in some sense doesn't eliminate kind of pagan instinct, but brings it to its natural goal without knowing it. So
rather baptizes it.
Exactly, baptized in that way. In fact, Pope Benedict in Spes Salvi has a beautiful little reflection in there talking about how the Star of Bethlehem, and I have a sneaking suspicion there'll be a question on on the wise men and some things wise guys as we get going here. But the idea is that the Star of Bethlehem and the birth of Christ, in some sense, culminates all of what came before it, that kind of astrology, the idea that the stars determined our destiny, and where Christ, and so we have the star or whatever that astrological phenomena was, in a sense, ushering in the new star of creation, that is Christ himself and the light of the world. So, in other words, the instinct that, or at least the argument that, if Christmas was born, was basically a repurposed pagan holiday, therefore it somehow diminishes Christmas, that's just a faulty argument. Okay, so that's the one thing to say. Having said that, it doesn't make sense historically. It's pretty shoddy, because the first remnants we have of the celebration of Sol Invictus comes 50-60 years after the first writings we have on the celebration of Christmas in the second century. Right, really? Sure, the 3rd century. Yeah,
so Christmas is older.
Yeah, at least in terms of its first writing. So there's some church fathers that talk about, and they take it from Daniel. There's the different how many weeks.
If you look in the book of Daniel,
in terms of the week of weeks, they calculate. You know, they come up with a calculation on when Christ must have been born based on the prophecy of Daniel of the coming of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And so they take that, and so there's writings that's out there in the ethos. Yeah. Well, it's not until about 50 years later, I think it is in almost the early 300s, the 240s, I think, that Summa Invictus kind of comes on the horizon. Now, the celebration of Christmas, kind of universally as a church, does come a little bit after that, but the idea that of when Christ was born was earlier than that. So, in other words, historically, doesn't make a lot of sense. Even if it did, even if for whatever reason you just ignored that, it doesn't somehow vitiate that thing. So I think, a theory which doesn't hold water, and even if it does, I don't think usually argues for what the people who promote it want it to claim. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's Summa Invictus. Alternatively, let me give you another kind of theory, and this one hinges on the kind of fittingness of the fullness of Christ, and it has to do with this. It has to do with is taking the locus point of all of our Christian faith as being centered in the greatest feast of the church, which is
Easter Sunday.
So it's interesting. I was talking to our kids when I was saying we were preparing for Christmas. Yeah. Did I share this story before?
Where I'm
I was
not
talking
sure.
when I was talking about, I shared it with a few people because this is so. Right, I was talking to our 4th, 5th graders, and I kind of was setting them up as sometimes I do. I said, "What's the most important, celebration of the church?" And of course, this is a couple of days before Christmas. And one of them said, "Well, you're not getting me." They said Easter, and I'm like, "Wow, you're right on the money." And then I said, "Well, what's the second most important day?" And then some fell into the sense of Christmas. Oh, Christmas, yeah. But others said, no, it was actually Pentecost.
I thought
that was an interesting kind of thing.
That is interesting, the coming spirit.
And then this is a good rather like, well, Jesus was born there, but maybe even more important than that is when Jesus actually was conceived. So Jesus was conceived.
The beginning of the story.
The beginning. So the incarnation.
Wow.
So Christmas is the birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But in some sense, that's just obviously the result of already the incarnation.
Of the Annunciation. Yeah, the Annunciation.
So Easter, most important. Second most important, Incarnation Day, Annunciation Day. And here's where we have on the Feast of the Annunciation is March 25th every year. And it usually lands adjacent or in Lent or, you know, sometimes even in Holy Week later than that. So sometimes Jesus has to be moved, that feast has to be moved around a bit. But here's the idea that, and this is what the whole theory hinges on, is that Jesus would have, as the complete human, the fullness of humanity, would have died on the day he was conceived.
Right.
That's the middle term there. And so the idea is that he died, and we know when Jesus died, like historically speaking, because it would have been over the Passover, and we just know that date.
We know that date. That's
so it's March 20th. March 25th of that year in 33 AD. That's when Passover would have been. So we know, and if you take the Johannine, the Gospel of John, when Jesus died, as the lambs are being slaughtered in the temple, as being historically, which most scripture scholars say is the most historically. On point gospel, then we know the day, we literally know the day Jesus died. So the idea then is like, okay, so if the day he was conceived was the day he died, right?
9 months later, December 25th
is when you celebrate his birth. So basically
No, but I was just thinking that last year, Good Friday was March 25th.
It was. That's exactly right. So in fact, that's what I hinted at, that sense of conception day. So if you believe Jesus was, and once again, this is a kind of fittingness argument,
right?
But it is rolling in that sense of history. Jesus conceived on March 25th. We know that was the day he died.
Yeah.
And then we just fast forward 9 months.
Yeah.
and you get Christmas. Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of theory number two. I think that's a pretty strong theory. But there's more.
Yeah, there's more.
Let's do the third door. Here's the third door. He goes, and that has to do because that even though there's a kind of there's a beauty in that mm-hmm. kind of theory, and yet history can be a little more messy than that.
Fair.
And the idea that Jesus conceived and died on the same day. There's nothing historic that necessarily. I mean, we don't know the Annunciation day, so there's historians will look at that and say, okay, well that's nice fittingness, but is there more? So here's I would say the more credible historical kind of theory, and that is actually connected to John the Baptist.
Okay.
So we know the relative dates of the birth of John the Baptist vis-a-vis Jesus, because the gospel, if we take the gospel as
6 months and all that. Yeah.
6 months, right? And we know we do have, even though we don't have the conception day for Jesus, mm-hmm. we argue that in that second theory, we just argue from when he died. We do have a pretty good inkling on when the proximate time in which John the Baptist was conceived.
Right.
Because the angel appears to him when his father, who's Zechariah, mm-hmm. is offering in the temple. He's standing before the Lord in that place. And by tradition, it's thought that Zechariah was the high priest. Now, it's not said this specifically in Scripture. So once again, even this theory makes a little bit of an inference mm-hmm. that Zechariah was the high priest. And therefore, the day he would have gone in to offer sacrifice would have been Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement.
Right.
And
to offer incense.
Exactly. Yeah. And that usually happens in the end of September. And in that day when when John the Baptist was conceived would have been the 25th of September that year. So that particular year. So that's September 25th, Yom Kippur, the day that he offered sacrifice, which would have been approximate to then, because he goes home, you know, he says, your wife will conceive. And John the Baptist isn't a virginal birth kind of scenario. So after his days,
this is natural.
He's a natural birth that happens. And so therefore, you have that. So John the Baptist conceived on September 25th, which means he's born on June. Well, we celebrate June 24th, 25th. Mm-hmm. So they're at that time. That's where the dates get a little bit fuzzy, but 24th, 25th.
Oh, I see.
And so on June 24th is the birth we celebrate as the church, the birthday
of John,
of John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And John the Baptist is born 6 months before Jesus is. So you do the math, 6 months from June 24th, 25th. December 24th, 25th. And this has the kind of fittingness that church fathers look at and say, well, that phrase that John the Baptist has that says, he must increase and I must decrease. Uh-huh. There was, once again, we're looking at a society and a culture that doesn't have quite the specificity of how the heavens go. And so they thought that the day June 24th in that time was mm-hmm. the longest day of the year. Yeah. And December, even though we have the solstice on the 21st now, not the 24th, but they were maybe a little off on that. But mm-hmm. basically that time of year after June 24th, they thought the days get progressively shorter.
Yeah.
So John the Baptist says, I must decrease.
Okay.
And the winter solstice
slowly increases
to be on the 24th, 5th, we now know it's the 21st, mm-hmm. the days get longer after that.
And so either way, it's this must
increase, right?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. so anyway, so those are two, and those much more likely than the first Sol Invictus, however you calculate that. That has, I think, probably a 3-star theory in my mind, from the 1 to 3-star with each being increasing, just because it's a little more messy in terms of it's kind of because Yom Kippur does not fall on the same day.
Right.
And so the Christians weren't quite right about that.
Yeah.
And the solstice isn't on the 24th, 25th as was mm-hmm. thought during that time. It's actually the 21st, as we know now. Once again, there's a little bit of, and wherever there's a little bit of gray area, I think that's probably more to the more to the truth. The history doesn't always fit neat patterns necessarily. And that idea of John the Baptist and calculating from that thing. So however you go, no one doubts that obviously Jesus existed. He was mm-hmm. born. And when it comes to the 25th, nobody knows. So the best you can do is be critical of it. But the question is why? The fact is we do celebrate.
Yeah.
Doesn't mm-hmm. it? So the question is, how do we come up with a theory that explains it? And I think the second and especially the third one do a good job of being rooted in the experience of the church, either working back from Easter and the Annunciation or from John the Baptist and his conception and birth as well. So there we go. December 25th, the birthday of Jesus.
Right, exactly.
So that leads us to the next question, question number two, and maybe asking just about the, and this is coming from one of our faithful listeners, why do people dress in green, red, and white during the Christmas season? So kind of taking off on some of the cultural celebrations. So Father Jose, maybe you can take this one. Colors, Christmas colors. Break it down for us.
Yeah, so the Christmas colors, I mean, you would see this all the time, especially in December, like out on the streets, green, red, and white. And, you know, these have, and ever since the medieval times, color means something. The colors actually have a particular meaning as liturgically, spiritually, and such. And green has always been the color of not only ordinary time, but also the color of hope, right? Mm. So that's when plants grow. And obviously, plants are mostly green, the leafy and all that such. So,
yeah, so signs of life.
Signs of life.
Christmas trees. You Christmas want a green. Trees. If you got a yellowing Christmas tree, no good.
That's when you see them on the,
on the curb.
On the curb. So, sorry. Yeah, probably like right now. But, but also with red and white, I mean, it's just interesting if you think about it. White, of course, is the color of purity. And then Jesus being the most pure sacrifice that we were ever given and such. And red, of course, from my namesake, from the prophet Isaiah, by his stripes we are healed. Mm. So I'm thinking that red is that symbol of his sacrifice.
Yeah.
The blood of his sacrifice. White is the color of purity, of the purity of Christ himself, and then green is the color of life.
Nice. No, those are, and because it's interesting, you don't normally think, I mean, you have, you know, Christmas, the birthday of Christ, it's like cute, sentimental kind of. And then the feast days you celebrate right after.
Yeah.
Are
Saint
like
Stephen.
Stephen, the martyr. The first martyr, the holy innocence.
Yeah.
Who else is in there? John the evangelist. Mm-hmm. So you've got all these portents to his death. I mean, he's born, and the next day you're thinking about martyrs.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah.
So there's already a kind of a foreshadowing there of Christ coming. Now, Fulton Sheen puts this way. He says, everyone who's ever been born comes to live. Jesus was born
in order to die.
He puts it that way.
But that also goes to the first question, the very fact that, you know, we are an Alleluia people. Our life is, in a way, it's centered on Easter Sunday and the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of the Lord. I mean, so our practices of Christmas should be informed by Easter and Good Friday and Holy Saturday is Dutch, right?
So, nice. Yeah.
So it makes sense. Yeah.
Nice. So maybe that just like the, maybe that the every next question fits into it. Any cultural practices in your family other than dressing in
ugly Christmas
ugly
sweaters,
Christmas sweaters and... which you broke out. I don't know. So here's some insight. Now, Father Isaiah, we had a Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
And we're all, you know, we're in our usual, we're all in our habits as usual, except one guy decides he's going to wear ugly Christmas sweater.
Who's that?
I don't know.
I didn't. Oh, I didn't see that. You know,
we had to look at it. You didn't have to look at it. You had to wear it. It was a little nippy, so.
It was cold upstairs.
It was cool. Where'd you get that monstrosity? It's cool.
So knowing that this is
so first of all,
audio,
this is audio. This is bad radio, but maybe just describe it for the audience.
So yeah, this is an audio medium. So to describe visually, it's a ugly Christmas sweater and based red with Rudolph with his red nose on front. So I have this little dangle like kind of hanging from my sternum, and then on the back is I was wearing Rudolph.
You were wearing Rudolph. You're telling. It was
no
it was
lights, quite, unfortunately.
It was so. Quite shy. We walk in, all of a sudden, I'm like, who's this guy? With his bright red Rudolph sweater.
Well, I was thinking about the Passion of the Lord.
Oh, por favor.
And then, you know, I was wearing the white habit, so there I am.
There you go. So other Christmas practices in your family?
Oh, in my family? Yeah. Well, by this time, our community is familiar with Sabangabi and the novena of Christmas masses.
Yeah.
And
some folks aren't. What is Sabangabi?
So Sabangabi, it's Tagalog, meaning basically night mass or mass of the rooster. So, so basically the 9 days before Christmas, you would have a night mass in the evening for the fishermen in the Philippines. So they come in and then they have mass together to prepare for Christmas Day.
Oh, no. Is it when they come back from fishing or when they're about to go out for fishing?
They're coming back.
Oh, so they come back like
Yeah.
Like, admit, so they fish all night and then they Yeah. Come back in the morning.
Mm-hmm. In the early morning, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually in the early. And so you would see some parishes, especially in like Daly City and such, that have they were having their masses at like 4 in the morning. And that's why.
Do fish eat at night? Is that, I didn't know that.
Apparently,
if you're a fish, I'm asleep. I'm not going for any hook.
Apparently,
or maybe they're just trolling. Maybe they're just like getting a big net.
Maybe the big net. I was told it's like there's a certain like fish tilapia. So tilapia like that, they get caught at night.
Oh.
So the best time to catch them at night. So
when they're not moving around.
When they're not moving around.
Oh,
yeah.
Very good. You learned something new on this. Didn't think we'd head into tilapia fishing in our Christmas special.
But yeah, I mean, okay,
the mass of the rooster happens in the morning.
Yeah.
Of course, here it happened at the bright early hour of 5:30 in the evening.
Yeah, it was great. That's great. You know,
it was really great. It was
and you
great.
Know, there's always a reception afterwards because you know we're Filipino. What you expect?
That's
and,
right.
But in my household,
was there lumpia?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So. I'll put up the photo later.
Yeah.
But I mean, in my household, I mean, we didn't, what my mom did, I didn't realize what she was doing until like college where I heard other families doing this too. So my mother, she would make it a point that in the front of the house, like near the door, she would have this bowl of 12 round fruit, at the door.
Yeah.
And apparently other Filipino families did it too, especially in my mother's region. And that would be, 12, you know, Christian number, and then just the roundness, just symbolizing eternity. So just a reminding the eternity of God on these days. So.
What kind of fruit? Persimmons?
Persimmons, apples.
No, were they persimmons? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, what if people, do you like give them out? Were they connected to like the 12 gifts of Christmas where you were given out, or they're just there? If she had company?
I'm assuming that if she had company, we would, I mean, it's like you have to give them something.
Yeah.
But I remember the bowl. I don't remember us actually giving the fruit away.
Okay. Tell me, just wouldn't go rotten.
Oh, no. No.
Okay.
I mean, it would actually, more specifically, it would be there between Christmas, the bowl will go out on Christmas Day, and then it would stay throughout the octave. So, and then on New Year's Day, then mom would make this gigantic fruit salad.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so fruit salad. Nice.
Yeah. So
great. Yeah. No. So, and I tend to think Christmas has a lot to do with in terms of practices around giving gifts, and you know, we do here in the community. We did our kind of a Christmas gift exchange, kind of white elephant, or they call it other. Kinds of things.
Yeah, stealing game
where you pick numbers, everyone gets a little gift, and you kind of like pass it around. That's what we used to, you know, of course we give gifts, but as a family gets bigger and there's a sense in which you don't necessarily get gifts for every particular person, it can be overwhelming at a certain point.
Right.
You just get one gift and you do the old swap. It was on Yankee Swap on the television show The Office.
Right, yeah.
And there's one guy gets like a gift that's like, yeah, you know, there's all these little kind of, you know, very homey kind of gifts, handmade. And the one guy gets, I think on that, have you ever seen that TV show?
Yeah, exactly.
He gets like a, like when it was still like the hot thing, like an iPod or something, or the newest iPhone, and everyone's like, it totally, one of these is not like the others.
Yeah.
And they always get stolen. So yeah, we had a couple of years ago, someone got like one of those tablets or something. I don't know, they must have got on sale. It kind of made the rounds. Everyone,
like, wow.
Everyone was after it. So the Inipro gin that we got one time.
Right. Yeah. That got stolen a couple of times.
That got stolen a couple of times.
I think simply to annoy the brother that unwrapped it.
Yes. That's right. Anyway, so yeah, so lots of Christmas cultural practices around food too, as you mentioned. Yeah. Gift giving, the 12 days of Christmas of giving little gifts for sure. And caroling's another kind of thing that lots of folks do. I know in our family we would... And it probably is best before Christmas, but even this time of year, we would go and just enjoy Christmas lights around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So up the street growing up, we had this home that would kind of trick out. And I think it was not just one house, but it was a kind of a cooperative of like four front lawns, two or three front lawns maybe. And they put all like Disney kids. They put like the whole shebang up there.
Wow.
And it was there.
So they were all shared.
Yeah, they were kind of all shared. Yeah. I don't know who coordinated, but it was quite in there. And then, in fact, I think in a local newspaper, I know this was when I was in Benicia which is has that small town feel.
Yeah.
There was in the local paper, they would put like the 12 best Christmas light kind of places around that. So Father nice. Bartolore and I actually made the rounds looking at, this is even after Christmas.
Wow.
Going and just visiting. And then of course, when we were growing up, we'd always have like a, you know, which one was the best, which one right. we're rating them.
You would rank them, yeah.
We'd rank them and things like that. So all sorts of ways to get into the Christmas spirit. And the whole point is that Christmas doesn't end on the 25th.
Right.
Begins on the 25th.
Right.
And hopefully
exactly.
we're doing the octave, those 8 days till New Year's Day. And then even after that, and continuing, which maybe brings us to the question of how long does a season last?
Yeah, so, how long because, does the season last?
Because there's certainly, we even asked that question, lets us know that it doesn't end then,
right.
but it's really the beginning of.
Yeah.
And there's certainly, so if you go, this is and someone who asked the question, Christina said, in parentheses, does it go to Michaelmas? I would that it would go to Michaelmas because Michaelmas is on the 29th of September.
September.
But I love Michaelmas because now, it unfortunately, it's the feast of Michael the Archangel and his companions. Exactly. God, I've got everyone trained at this point. Everyone knows what it really is. Everyone who comes into my circle of influence, you know, small as it is.
But, oh, by the way, yeah. So that episode where he has that debate with Father Gabriel and Father Raphael is episode number something. I didn't get that.
you don't remember?
Didn't look that up.
It's an epic one. Back to the Christmas lasts. There's 8 days of the octave.
Right.
So all the way through January 1st.
Yeah.
Then there is the 12 days of Christmas.
Right.
Which then coincides with Epiphany, although transferred to Sunday usually, but it can fall any day of the week. It's just the 6th.
Yeah. It's traditionally January 6th, which is the 12th day after December 25th.
That's right.
But, you know, it's usually that Sunday.
It usually falls on the closest Sunday after that.
Right.
So you have Christmas, then the proximate Sunday is always the Holy Family. Holy Family.
Yeah.
And depending on when Christmas falls, that the baptism of the Lord can get nixed or not.
Right,
sometimes
right.
it's the Monday after the Epiphany. But
right.
this year we've got the triumvirate and the Holy Family, the Epiphany, and then baptism of our Lord. So it goes. But we're still in Christmas season. It's not until after the baptism of the Lord that then we get into ordinary time. So basically from the 25th until this year it'll be the 12th.
Yeah. January.
Basically you run 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You run 3 weeks after Christmas if Christmas doesn't fall on a weekend.
Right.
That's kind of the short answer.
Right.
Otherwise, if Christmas, like it was a few years ago, ends on Sunday, you kind of lose that Sunday, if you will. The fourth Sunday of Advent is really curtailed it was.
Exactly.
It's basically a day.
Yeah.
And then Christmas Eve is Sunday. And then
that was a hard
Monday
day.
That was cheek by jowl, as they say.
Yeah.
And then you baptism becomes the first even Monday after
the day after
the Epiphany because it'll fall on the 6th.
Right.
And then you go to ordinary time. But, and this is what our questioner might be asking, there is, before the Vatican Council, the idea that Christmas was actually longer than that and went all the way to February 2nd.
Aha, presentation.
The presentation of the Lord, which this year is on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And so you basically have the whole month of January as a celebration of Christmas. So, and this fits with the kind of that New Year theme. And so I know that in my talking about household and traditions that fire danger notwithstanding, the early household kept their tree up until February 2nd.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Mama
and you
early.
Had real trees.
We
right?
had real trees.
Okay, we had a real tree. Okay.
Even till today.
Okay.
Real trees. We picked out the tree down in it. We bought local Half Moon Bay. The family
Amen.
Got their tree. You always have to pick if you're buying. I remember growing up, we would sometimes even get the tree on the day after Christmas, the 26th.
Really?
Yeah, because then they're cheap. I mean, trees
Who
can
cares?
Be a little
expensive.
So we just go and say, we slip the guy $5 and, you know, he's going to throw away the trees anyway. So you just grab it. I remember one time the tree purveyor thought we were, of course, I have my big beard. He thought we were Orthodox because the Orthodox actually, some of the Orthodox, right, because of their calendar, celebrate Christmas after, you know, we would celebrate Christmas. He's like, oh, you darn Orthodox, trying to chip me out of my, I'm like, you're going to throw these trees away anyway. So, but the problem there is, even if you buy the tree later on, it doesn't mean the tree is not already dying. See, here's the thing. So the point is, long way of saying, you got to keep your, there's a challenge to keep your tree fresh for a whole month so it doesn't burn down your house or your abode. So Christmas lasts until baptism of the Lord in our current, and that's when we actually take down the trees here at St. Dominic's is the feast of the baptism of the Lord. So that leads us to our next question, which is sent in, has to do with one of those sorts of foods.
Yeah.
The candy cane. Does the candy cane. This is actually a good question.
This is a fun one.
In fact, someone came with candy canes and they were giving them to you, and you were mentioning the theological import. Tell me, I wasn't so familiar with the theological meaning of the candy cane. Yeah, so lay it on me. What's the theological meaning of the candy cane? I know they're sweet.
Yeah, they're sweet.
I know they're very nutritious.
Incredibly, as in they have details on the nutritional panel at the back of the box.
That's right. They're nutritional because they have the sugar content listed. Okay,
so So I'm going to answer like the actual traditional red and white peppermint flavored candy canes, right?
Are there different ones?
Not the chocolate ones, not the multicolored rainbow ones. I'm talking about the actual
traditional. Not the Sour Patch Kids one? Those are my favorite.
Those are pretty good. I'm not going to admit. I'm not going to deny goodness of that. Okay. But I mean, the theology, if you want to get into theology, you have to talk about the actual traditional red and white peppermint candy canes, right? So for one thing, I mean, look at it. Look at the kind of the form of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it one way, it looks like a shepherd's staff, right? But if you turn it upside down, it looks like a J. So you can take, you know, a shepherd's staff or J for Jesus, right? So there's that one thing.
And the shepherd's staff... Does that maybe harken back to the fact that Santa Claus himself was a bishop?
Yes.
Your Honor, we have leading the witness here. No, I know, as you said it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you should have seen the look on both of our faces.
No, because as you were saying, the staff, I was thinking, so you've got the bishops, you know. Staff or Crozier, right?
Yeah.
And the Crozier comes from that episcopal accoutrement liturgically that he
Jeopardy words here.
Yeah, exactly, that he uses. So basically, the candy cane is mirroring the shepherd's staff, a la Bishop's Crozier, and of course Saint Nicholas, as we had last month talking about. His role in the personage or the character of Saint Nicholas is there. So okay, so candy cane
or the shepherds themselves, right? Okay. Or the shepherds themselves in Matthew, right?
But I think
that's Gospel of Matthew.
They should sell a brand of candy canes called Saint Nick's Croziers.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if those already exist.
Really?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, you keep talking. I'm looking that up right
now. Okay, so he's going to look that up. So meanwhile, we're talking about the very fact that the traditional candy canes are white and red, right? Mm-hmm. And as we said earlier about the colors of Christmas, like colors of green, white, and red, white representing the purity of Christ, red representing the Christ's passion, right? That's why it's striped, because we're harkening back to what Isaiah said in his prophecies, by his stripes we are healed. So that's why we have the white stripes, we have the red stripes going down this white cane. And lastly, because why the flavor of peppermint is important is because, one, it harkens back to the wise men who gave spices to the child Christ. And also apparently the taste of mint and peppermint has healing properties in some cultures.
Who doesn't like mint?
And who doesn't like mint? I mean, come on.
Yeah. So, yeah. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. No, so peppermint is connected to Christ as well. I didn't quite. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the healing
properties.
Power. Yeah, property. Mint. Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, specifically.
So. I love because this is, you know, like with here's guilty pleasure confessions here. Mm-hmm. I love certainly ice cream, but the peppermint bark ice cream.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Now you're talking.
Oh yeah.
Well, no. But I am staring right now. So you have the traditional candy cane that just kind of like, it's kind of like a hook, but there are If you can buy candy canes that kind of loop it, so the they look like more like a crozier.
They look like actual croziers.
Yeah, it's almost like a question mark. Kind of the interior of the crook is swirled all the way in. So you can indeed buy what are called St. Nicholas croziers, which look exactly like croziers. There's a little more bend to them, and you can buy them.
I'm overwhelmed with giddiness right now.
This is it. Power of the internet. This is the fun that comes when you don't prepare and you're just when you're free flowing as we are. So there we go.
I'm overcome with giddiness right now.
Oh, you're okay. Let's talk about the music. This is one of the most musical times of the year.
Certainly,
we mentioned that for Advent. We've had, three or four different opportunities to carol here at the church in terms
of beautiful.
We had an Advent concert that began Advent. We had the Christmas caroling, the Messiah.
Yeah,
the church
Messiah
was packed.
Oh my goodness, just people
church
flowing out.
Oh my goodness,
great.
Yeah, we had over
fantastic
1,000 people maybe for that beautiful moment. We have, of course, before the midnight mass, we had the traditional caroling before that.
So that was great.
So we had at our parish party, we had a little kind of open mic, a little scary.
Yeah, that was fun.
We rumpa-pum-pummed.
That's true.
I did my drummer boy.
You were the drummer boy, that's true.
We were the drummer boy going. So anyway, it's the Christmas time of year. When is it, from Rebecca, okay to start listening to Christmas carols, and how long should your tree and lights keep up? And so I've given my opinion on that February 2nd. How about
February 2nd? Yeah, why not?
What say you? Well, maybe take the first part of it. Is it okay to do Christmas carols during Advent?
You know my answer. Advent is Advent, right? So I mean, there's that part of me. There's that hypocritical part of me that would say like, no, keep Advent, and then on the midday of 24, that's when you can start.
Old school.
Yeah. I mean, there's that
just
part of me.
Like Lent. You don't even take the Sundays off unless you, this is really.
No, but okay. But Father Michael, I mean, I said the word hypocritical for a reason. Because like just the other day, I was driving down to Fresno to visit mom.
It was on KYT
the entire time.
Your little Bing Crosby crooning to you?
Oh, yeah.
Chestnuts were roasting on an open fire?
Yeah, and then listen to the Christmas carol on the drive up. It was great.
You were walking in a winter wonderland?
I was. I was jingling, lingling, and all that stuff, yeah.
The weather outside was spiteful?
It was spiteful, yes.
Yeah. Anyway,
and the fire and the heater was very delightful.
The warmth was very delightful.
It wasn't snowing, but it was raining.
So strictly speaking, you're saying no Christmas carols before Christmas and after that. So that's impossible in my mind.
I know. Yeah. That's why I said the word hypocritical.
No, but it is. Certainly there is a way in which. I'll put it this way: what can happen often is Christmas fatigue before we even start celebrating Christmas. So that's actually what more of I don't find my celebration of Christmas is diminished by having a certain amount of Christmas spirit and festivity beforehand.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But what can happen is it feels like if you do too much of it, or if it's just so overwhelming for so long, if you start celebrating after, after Thanksgiving basically, then by the time you get, you're just like, okay, you can only take so much, and you're like, okay, onto the, I've been there, done that. Let's move on. So I guess personally speaking, and in terms of the way we celebrate it here at the parish, we have little moments of it, where we gather together, knowing that practically speaking, this is the time of year when people are gathering, people are home from school, families are together, they're often traveling after Christmas. Yeah. So practically speaking, having little moments of Christmas celebration even before Christmas, not the worst thing in the world. What the diminishment comes is if it's full on, ramped up to volume 10 celebration, in the weeks octave before, especially these days of Oantiphon, which we've talked about before, where we kind of really kind of let go or have kind of vigil for Christmas in a way that really kind of sets our expectation for it. So that would be, just kind of the practice of that, just as long as it's not diminished going forward.
Yeah.
Having said that, maybe just get personal about Christmas songs.
Oh, yeah.
Someone wants to know, what are your three top Christmas songs?
Should I go first?
Yeah, I'm interested. This is actually the fun part. Is when we don't like check in with each other beforehand. I've got no idea what you're going to say.
Well, I mean, my all-time favorite Christmas song is "O Holy Night."
Oh yeah,
I just can't. Yeah. I remember the first time I listened to it when I actually remember listening to it. It was the Pavarotti version, and I was like 12 years old or something, and it's just ever stuck with me ever since. So for me, that's when I know it's December, it's Christmas season, it's Advent when I hear "O Holy Night" the first time. My number two.
So just in terms of like what gets me about "O Holy Night" is the, you know, the high notes, you know, when you're, mm-hmm. you hit those high notes towards the end, the fall on your knees, and yeah. I think it's a French canticle or a hymn, but you hit those high notes and it's like, whoa, those are spine tingly. Yeah. Nice. You mentioned Pavarotti.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah. So
that's the first one I remember. Yeah. Like cognitively listening to me. First time I was actually moved by a Christmas song. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I want to say, was it Pavarotti or Bocelli? Because I think the number one, like, it may be Pavarotti.
Yeah,
who did Pavarotti.
I don't know. Now I don't know. I remember it was like a three tenors thing. Remember?
When so it would have been Pavarotti. Yeah. Okay, I think the number one. Well, actually, I think the number one is, and this is a shout out to those who love her, Celine Dion has the number one "O Holy Night" cover. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it's like the number one.
Why not?
"O Holy Night," but I think Bocelli's in there too on his most bought Christmas album.
Wow.
So that's definitely a spectacular. How can you go wrong with "O Holy Night"? So number two.
My number two, I've always had an affection for the Carol of the Bells.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. How does that one go? Yep, exactly.
Especially that one commercial with the Hershey's Kisses, but all the kisses are bells and all that stuff. I just can't.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
So I mean, that's, yeah. By the way, that's also my favorite Christmas commercial too. So there you are.
But it's in that one. That one's
where the kisses, they look like bells. Uh-huh. They're treated like bells, and like, you know, they're swung by the little tissue part and all that.
Oh,
so,
I see. Oh, nice. I'll have to look that up. I'm not sure. So Carol, but too strong. Two for two. And number three?
Charlie Brown, man.
Charlie Brown? Is
Christmas
that a song?
Christmas time is here. Yeah.
Christmas time
is here. Yeah.
Charlie Brown. Nice.
From the Christmas Star Special. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. I don't know. I'm going to have to listen to that one. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, but I grew up with like Mickey's Christmas Carol and the Charlie Brown Christmas. So, So that's...
Nice.
So my ode to my homage to Mr. Schultz. So there
very
is.
Nice. So for myself, I think it may be perhaps the first one that springs to mind is I don't know if this counts, but Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
the question did not presuppose Christian context.
There's a great version by this Irish band. Come on, how can you? Know, like,
yeah, it's
so
great.
It's so dark. It's so dark. No,
this has nothing to do with your own grandmother, does it?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's the irony of it is at a time when most Christmas songs are very, as you say, kind of sentimental and put aside, having this like this, like, you know, the worst tragedy you can imagine, your grandmother getting killed on Christmas, and it's just kind of like very, very dark. How about see "Joy to the World"? I think is that's
solid,
just like it's just solid.
Solid,
the joy,
number two, solid.
Yeah. So number three, "Joy to the World." It's kind of like it's kind of your classic. At least since I've been here, I've asked for it to be kind of the recessional, because there's nothing quite like singing "Joy to the World" as kind of the culminating moment of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in the thing. The "Angels We Have Heard on High," just for the refrain.
Oh yeah, Gloria. Yeah.
So and oftentimes that's used for the glory, that just refrain. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets, you know,
everybody gets into it.
Yeah, even if you can't sing well, everyone knows the oh.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of like belt it out, and it's kind of like even the most inelegant singers. And those with great voices can kind of blend, it makes this kind of mashup harmony that everyone kind of is full throat. You can be full throated. You don't have to be too precious when you sing that.
That's true. Yeah.
"Silent Night," another one that's
solid.
Just a classic, and the story behind it too of the of the pastor who wrote it just very quickly, just contemplating what he was going to preach for his
wow.
his Christmas homily, and this is the kind of the idea that Christ is born in this kind of I put it silent, hidden way, and since then has been, I think, maybe translated into at least the lyrics into, you know, hundreds of different you know, languages over
wow.
the years. I think Franz Gruber put the music to the Joseph Mora lyrics, and it was performed I think for the first time in the 1800s, but just yeah, just a classic there. But I think my number one is Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Ooh,
yeah.
So that's classic.
Solid. Yeah. So in fact, I was bringing this up at the table the other day, and it's I didn't realize, but it was the original lyrics written by Charles Wesley.
Charles Wesley.
Yeah. So not
wow.
not a
Catholic. It's an American hymn.
Yeah. No. So okay. So Charles Wesley was the English leader of the Methodists.
Oh, okay. England. Okay. British.
England.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah. He wrote, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 hymns. So very yeah. much a composer in that way. But one of the whole Wesley brothers.
Okay.
And yeah. Methodism coming on the scene in the mid 1700s.
Wow.
But the tune. And this was what I didn't know this either, was composed by Mendelssohn, the German composer. That's with Father Anselm.
Huh.
So, cause I said,
I'm sure he's very proud of that.
So yeah, yeah and tweaked since then a bit, but basically adapted by a tune, a Christmas tune. That I won't even try to pronounce the German name for.
I can just say like this artificial German Father Anselm. Yeah, and some voice like the
Vaterland in dein Gaun. Yeah, anyway. Anyway, I hope he's not
good luck with that, yeah.
The melody from the Fetch Gans Ding Gong. Anyway.
Sure.
You've got
sure. Have fun with that.
And anyway, so yeah, Hark the Herald Angels Sing might be my number one. But I do like your you've got the old Holy Night is a good one. Actually my favorite you got Bing Crosby.
Oh yeah.
So how can you beat the Bing?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of simply instrumental,
mm-hmm.
I think I do like the. I don't know if you've heard of the group. This goes back a ways, but the Mannheim Steamroller.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
oh, yeah.
Those were very. In fact, I was. Someone was playing it at the Christmas party. There was this one had a CD of it, and they've done a lot of. They do other than mm-hmm. Christmas music, but I think probably their famous, most
right.
prominent and famous arrangements have to do with. Christmas carols,
right,
so
like yeah.
they have 5 or 6 CDs, and we had them growing up, and so just yeah. we listened to them over and over
yeah.
and over. So
mm-hmm.
I feel like, and for those are ones I don't often listen to before Christmas.
Yeah,
I listen to them after Christmas,
mm-hmm.
that I shouldn't say after. I just got through saying there is no after, but
yeah.
during Christmas,
during the Christmas season yeah.
after the 25th.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Because that really brings it a lot. That mm-hmm. for me, hearing those arrangements. Really kind of set the mood for Christmas in
yeah.
a way. So
yeah,
good. So moving right along, maybe to get back to some of the more historical kinds of questions, flip-flopping, here's a question from Trish on how do... Oh, no. So, yeah, Trish, the slaughter of the innocents. So this is the Holy Innocents.
Yeah.
Seems really extreme. Was King Herod really that bad?
Well, yes.
Yeah, no. Herod the Great was not a very popular figure.
No.
And here's how you know, because if you look at historical, you know, renditions of him or what history gives it. Now, these days you can find people who are apologetic for, you know, people from Stalin.
For anybody,
right?
Yeah.
There are people who would defend, you know, Hitler is misunderstood. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean...
Yeah.
In some ways, it's not as if no one's ever said anything good about Herod. And we're talking about Herod. This is Herod the Great.
Herod the Great, yeah. So the first Hasmonean king.
That's right.
That was appointed by Mark Antony and all that such.
And Herod just was part of the gospel story. We know
right.
that he was alive during the birth of Jesus. So mm-hmm. that's all historically true, yeah. accurate, and on point.
These are the guys who the Magi visited. The Magi went to Herod's place first.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
But both... In the years after that, both Jewish historical sources mm-hmm. and Christian historical sources agree that Herod was not a great guy.
No.
So, and Jewish historical sources and Christian historical sources don't agree on a lot of things.
Yeah.
So when they do agree, time to, you know,
look at this. Really look at this seriously.
You take that seriously. In other words, they have no incentive to necessarily just confirm what each other are saying. There's no kind of feedback loop there. They definitely have different takes on, well, obviously who Jesus is and lots of other subjects. So, and the question of the Holy Innocents, it's interesting because when I visited Bethlehem, the place where Jesus is born is also the current burial site of a lot of the relics of those children that were killed during that time period.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So you go, you come into the Church of Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity there, and you can actually go to the purported place where Jesus was born and venerate that place. And then if you walk underneath the church, there's a kind of catacomb, and it's where the where you just see. And it's interesting because they're not in reliquaries. They're just kind of, you can't get to it. It's kind of sectioned off. But they're basically, it's a graveyard of sorts, and the
of bones all these
are
children.
Just, the bones just kind of strewn there, and there's a partition there, and then there's a little cave, for lack of a better term, where Saint Jerome lived, and that's where Jerome, the famous saint, doctor of the church, one of the fathers, the forefathers of the church, who translated the scriptures.
Right.
That's where he had his abode, so right in that place. So it's a very powerful place. There are those, I think, historically that say, well, we don't have a lot of historical corroboration outside the Gospel of Matthew that, you know, Herod went on this killing spree of every child. We don't have a great purge attestation in some of the history. Mm-hmm. So there are those that say it didn't really happen, or we don't have enough history to say that. We do know, though, that Herod got tired of his first wife and executed her and all of his own children.
Right. Yeah.
So that's a fact.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The question is, King Herod really that bad? Well, I don't know. What's worse, killing, children that might be ascendants to your throne, or killing your own family because you're scared they might inherit your kingdom?
Right. Put it this way.
I would think the latter. So even let's just say that maybe there wasn't a systematic killing of all the holy innocents necessarily. The fact is, King Herod historically killed his own children and did a lot of other things that history does not look kindly on from any perspective.
Yeah. I mean, and from the Roman point of view too, the Emperor Augustus actually said, better to be Herod's pigs than one of his own sons.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have the Emperor as well as Christian and Jewish sources saying all these bad things about this one guy, it's likely true.
He said that the man did have, he rebuilt the temple.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
And he did, in terms of like his, I mean, he's Herod the Great for a reason. He restored a lot of what had been, conquered by the Romans, and the Romans put him in charge of the place.
They appointed him. Yeah,
exactly. So he was in a tough position of trying to conciliate, and yet his huge ego trying to start a dynasty and conciliate the Romans, the Jewish people, and the diaspora, Jews living outside. Yeah. That's almost kind of an impossible kind of feat. And he certainly erred on the side of legacy, egotism, and killing off any potential threat or otherwise. So not a nice guy.
Yeah. So
was he really that bad?
It's conceivable that the slaughter of the innocents actually did happen under his watch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Or some kind of. Yeah. So, I mean, whether or not it was of every male in the whole area, or a concentrated group, or even his own. Yeah. Children, right? Mm-hmm. So he definitely killed young innocents.
Yeah.
That's pretty much a fact. So on that happy note, maybe kind of coming back to, if you will, the beautiful moment of that place of Bethlehem. Gregory asks, I've seen some nativity scenes that happen in a barn, others in a cave. Is this just the artist's interpretation, or is there something deeper going on in these two traditions? So cave, barn, Motel 6. Where was Jesus born?
Bellagio.
Bellagio. Where was Jesus born?
Well, I mean, like, so for one thing, there's, I mean, this, for in some traditions, now you would have to tell me before I would know about Bethlehem, but sometimes some caves are barns. That's where the animals are actually stored. So, so why not both? But there is that kind of symbolic fittingness of Jesus being born in a cave because his body was laid in a newly
in a tomb.
A cave, effectively as well. So, so theologically.
And how to put it, I think barn, like when I say barn, we think of like a wooden structure that's kind of like, you know, we think like the Midwest where you keep cows or something like that.
Gigantic red building.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, even the idea of a place, a barn is a place to keep animals. Most animals in the ancient areas are the kind of animals that either can kind of like live proximate to your home. So there's kind of like, say, house animals kind of around, you know, chickens and so forth that kind of live proximate to your, or if they demand any kind of feeding or pasteurization, you have to take them out to the pasture.
Right.
So that means when you gather them in for the night, you're talking about some kind of like with sheep or something like sheepfold or something like that. And you don't want to be depending on where you're grazing them, which are multiple locations. You don't have space and time to like have multiple barns to bring them. So you're just going to use a natural geography to be able to do so. But you basically found a rocky outcropping or some other natural formation. And then like Jesus says, I'm the gate. And that's how the shepherd just laid across the opening of a cave or some kind of rocky outcropping that would just naturally form for you. So the likelihood that this is kind of like the traditional like barn that we met is probably not, probably not historic, and probably comes from the St. Francis instinct. So Francis
of Assisi,
St. Francis of Assisi, who in his own time in the 1200s brought about that culture and that devotion to have a kind of a living Bethlehem scene to make it real. And there you would have a different, you know, Western European idea of how to house animals rather than an ancient Near Eastern way to house animals. So either way, the point of whatever context you're imagining, it's a place for animals, which sometimes we can sentimentalize a little bit. Like this is like, oh, it's this kind of, well, I don't know if you've ever been in a place where animals...
Have you been in a farm before?
Hang out. It's not... so you're going to need more than just your car freshener to kind of keep it smelling fresh. The straw may or may not be... You know, you put straw down so it helps so you're not slipping around, so to speak.
What'd you say?
Right, it's easy to, it's easy for cleanup. Think litter box. And or a manger is a place where you the animals eat
it's
from.
It's a feeding trough.
It's a feeding trough. So there's lots of wonderful symbolism, and there is certainly, and I'm not looking to debunk or rob folks of the sentimentality and the sweetness of the moment, but it's earthy. it's real. It has a kind of visceral kind of, this is not, it's humble. I'll put it that way. It's humble. It's not usually a place where the family hangs out on a cold winter's night. It's where you put the animals. It's where the quote unquote innkeeper who didn't have room, but you know, said, well, I've got that. And just kind of like, it's kind of like,
it's
not exactly
mean.
The outhouse, but very kind of humble and meager for sure. So yeah, that was, and it fits with the whole Christmas story is one where you have God becoming human, and lest we think that somehow this is not beneath God, or the humility of God is on total display, in which God comes in a way that's not just humbling for a God becoming human, but it's humble in comparison to humanity's own sense of what a home and hearth should be like.
Yeah, you can't get much more humble than how...
From a human perspective.
From a human point of view.
Yeah, you can't get much more human from a... human perspective, in order that we might appreciate the humility of the moment from God's perspective.
Right. Yes.
And therefore the power of humility in our own lives. So, and that might lead to, maybe just let's wrap up. So this is, that was question 10.
Yeah.
So we haven't really been counting down, but I did number these, so 11. Yeah. So we've got two more final two questions. Maybe we'll do kind of more practical questions from Rebecca. How do we deepen the experience of Christmas for folks who are converts to the faith and maybe come from Jewish or Muslim or perhaps not even any kind of religious experience and don't have didn't grow up with the kind of Christmas tree and lights and kind of the culture of that, what can we do to deepen the experience for them when it's not supported by this kind of, if you will, sentimental or cultural kind of surrounding?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, my first reaction is the fact that many of these symbols that we see for Christmas and or Advent, they're not merely and only cultural, but rather they are theological as well. Like what we talked about the candy cane, for example, you know, they speak about the story of Jesus. And so just kind of illuminating and educating ourselves in that in order to educate others about, you know, taking away, I mean, not to say that the cultural part is bad, not at all, but to say that there are these deeper theological meanings in what is the Christmas tree, why light, all these things that we have that are prevalent as symbols within the Christmas season.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's a way in which sometimes the very things that can draw us into the season can be limitations because we're not pressed to go further, right? We kind of stay in the kind of the warm glow of, you know, the Christmas lights.
The sentimental milieu.
Exactly. We don't actually dig a little deeper. So what brings us in can also keep us from going deeper. So in some sense, being a convert, you get kind of a fresh take or a fresh look on the reality of what we're celebrating. That is the birth of Christ, the revelation of that God has become one of us and has come to save us. And so that can be maybe appreciated if it's not necessarily not encumbered but just only based on that sense of you know, what did I get for Christmas? did I like my presents, did we have a good time with family? Was the Christmas prime rib, was it real prime rib, or was it overcooked, or was it simply a kind of ribeye? You know, whatever it is, it's not limited by that way. The other thing, and sometimes this makes me think when I do marriage preparation and we talk about starting a family, you know, and being a couple together. And a question that sometimes comes up is, how is this going to affect your relationship with your respective families? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, now you're not only are you married to each other, you're both in-lawed, so to speak.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so, especially for those who have been married and probably know this or become, you know, this, every family deals with this to some extent.
Exactly, yeah.
Where do we spend the holidays, especially for younger folks who are married, who have parents that are in kind of centers of home and gravity that both have grown up celebrating that? So where do you go to this family or that family, or do you split it, or how do you work that and doing that? And what I normally would advise is, you know, you've vowed yourself to each other, so maybe it's a good time for you to start making new traditions.
Yeah.
Right? The traditions that you had as family is good, but you don't necessarily have to try to recreate that in a way with the other person. Now you vowed yourself to each other. You know, so, I mean, obviously there might be, you certainly want to see other, you know, your own family, things like that, but don't think of it as I'm losing what I used to do or I can no longer do it, but now we're going to do something new as a family. Now is the creation of a new family experience, and we're going to, you know, God willing, if we have children and family, it's a time for a fresh look. So whenever sense of, you know, to me, the question isn't simply how can we bring converts into the experience of Christmas that we had, but how can we, in a sense, encourage them to find their own ways of, now that they've come to the faith and, you know, come to the fullness of Christ and his birth, what kinds of things make sense for them to celebrate, right? Maybe using those traditional things, but maybe even doing creative ways in which it makes sense to them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
no wrong way to celebrate Christmas if the focus is on Christ.
Right.
If the focus is on Christ, go for it, in my mind.
Yeah. You bring up a very profound point there, because if Christmas, I mean, if our understanding of Christmas kind of boils down to presents and gingerbread cookies, well, I mean, we have to dare to go deeper and more profound.
I like gingerbread cookies.
Yeah, so do I. Especially if you have, like, you know, chocolate chips or whatever.
Oh, you gotta bring chocolate into it.
Why are you bringing chocolate? We have to bring chocolate into it. What's okay, fine.
Raisins. Gingerbread and raisins.
But my point,
I knew I'd get you on that. Go ahead. Sorry, you were saying I made a profound point. Why did I interrupt you? What was my profound point?
Yeah, your profound point is that if Christmas is simply about those more superficial things of like presents and you know, visiting family for dinner and all that such, if it ends there,
if it's only
it's like, well, you're not going as far as God would like you to go. I mean, we're talking about the very mysteries of God here. Yeah. So go deeper, as long as it's focused on Christ. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe that's a good, Joe asks, this is a question number 12, exactly that, besides Mass, and I like how he asked that, besides Mass, because—
Good start. Well,
because Christmas literally means Christ's Mass. So really, if we're not going to Mass on Christmas—
You're doing it wrong.
You're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong, right? So that would be the very first start. I love how he starts. Besides Mass, which is in the very name, how do we refocus Christmas, the Mass of Christ, and that time and season on the birth of our Lord instead of simply secular commercialism?
Well, Christmas begins on December 25th.
Yep. Or the 24th.
Or the 24th, the night of the 24th, and it ends on January 12th this year.
Exactly.
So, I mean, let's begin the season with gusto, right?
Yeah.
So
today we've got, what are we, 5 day, where this is being released on it's going to be Monday on the 30th. So we've got days,
and
you ask yourself,
sixth day of Christmas. Yeah.
What, you're true. We just got the 5 golden rings.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. And so, no, I would say in terms of, in some ways, I don't want to be, I really never found it helpful to say, we should reject secular consumerism from the sense of like, we shouldn't give gifts or we shouldn't.
Yeah,
No, those are all ways in expressing it. But I would say let's go deeper. And this is where you have to kind of get creative. So ask yourself the questions, how does my celebration of Christmas bring Christ alive for others?
Right.
What am I doing this Christmas to receive Christ's light in terms of my prayer?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of my openness to, and this as we head towards this week, the first of the year, those sense of who does Christ want me to be in 2020?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what changes do I need to make in my life?
What that, gift can I be to Christ, right?
Exactly. Like, Christ is always asking us to grow. And if he's not asking us to grow, that means we're not listening or we're not hesitant. So maybe it means we're going to, take on or open ourselves up to a deeper experience of God in prayer. Setting aside the time we need, especially in the busy time. Maybe it means taking on an act of service for someone, or a habitual way of saying, okay, this year I struggle with patience, for example. Okay, what am I going to do during this hectic time of year to be a little more patient? Or in a sense, maybe there's someone in my life that I know is really hurting and maybe lonely, and I don't find it easy to be in their company, but I'm going to reach out and just, reach out to them in some way, give them a call, go out with them, go get a drink or something. Just reach out to them and connect with them. In other words, how is Christ present to me, and how do I make Christ present to someone else? And if we can't directly point to how we've helped someone else experience Christ in a way we've interacted with them, then there's diminishment, I think. I think we haven't celebrated that Mass of Christ to its full extent. The last words we hear at every Mass, and particularly at Christmas, is to go forth, your ascent, ite mises, go forth, your ascent, go in peace, to love and serve the Lord, to glorify the Lord by our lives. Yeah. There's several different ways, but that there's ascending forth at the end of every Mass.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so to ask yourself those two questions, number one, how did I receive Christ anew?
Yeah.
What is he asking from me? And how am I bringing Christ alive for someone else? And during these 12 days of Christmas, hopefully you have experienced that. Or if not, you have a plan as we come to the new year to open your hearts wide again to receive the Lord Jesus. Perhaps even that sense in which you've been able to reach out and to make Christmas a powerful a moment of Christ coming to birth in their lives. Whatever it is, that's what the celebration of Christmas is all about.
So Merry Christmas, Father Michael. Yeah,
Merry Christmas, Father Isaiah.
So you know how to help out with the podcast, to subscribe, like, comment, all those other things on social media and all those things.
So may all that we do during this Christmas day, as we continue on Christmas day all the way through the first and this Christmas season through the baptism of the Lord, truly radiate the joy of the gospel, this Christmas gospel, here in the heart of the city. Amen.
Amen.